Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. And this morning, I'd like to welcome our new listeners in Seattle listening to KBFG LPFM 107.3. Toward the end of 2016, Sightline Institute's programs director, Eric DePlace, created a Trump time capsule project. He sent out an email to his friends and colleagues asking them to write down their predictions for the future, trying to envision the unusual events and disruptions of the impending Trump presidency. Will Trump be impeached? Over what issue? Will he start a war? With whom? Will the markets melt down? What will trigger it? This morning, Eric returns to Locus Focus to open the time capsule and see if anyone could have possibly imagined what has actually transpired in the past year. We'll talk about fears that have been realized as well as achievements that have successfully repelled parts of the Trump agenda, particularly in local struggles to stop fossil fuel development in the Northwest. Eric, welcome to Locus Focus.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Barbara.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
And I hope it is a Happy New Year.
So far, it is.
So have you opened the capsule for, I know we're a couple weeks early because you're going to open it on January 20th, the first anniversary of the inauguration of Donald Trump. But have you opened it to see how it correlates with what's actually come down in the last year?
I have opened it, and I've been thumbing through it this morning, trying to figure out if there are any sort of trends or consistencies through here. And, you know, people are all over the map, really, but lots of fun stuff for sure.
So, what would you say were the predictions that came the closest to actually matching what's come down?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I mean, like I guess one of the pieces of context that's helpful is this idea was sort of born on election night when I was at a bar at the Pike Place Market with some friends of mine and some people from work, and we were just sort of staring at each other with these. You know, these kind of our jaws on the floor, wondering what the hell is going to happen to the country. So then I thought, and everyone had their ideas. So I thought, well, let's take the time to write it down so we can check back later on. But I'm going to answer your question in a moment. But I think it's interesting that the thing that almost everybody got wrong, including two investment bankers. So I emailed this out to a whole bunch of people I work with or know on a personal professional level. They come from a whole range of different professions, but two people who are real experts in finance, and both of them predicted a stock market meltdown by a year out. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Now it was actually the people who don't work in finance who had generally predicted that the stock market might be artificially pumped up and reaching new highs. And I think, in fact, Barbara, one of your responses said something like that, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't remember, actually. But, you know, I was remembering the night of the election, the night of the election returns. I mean, there was a ticker that was going on the bottom of the screen as it was becoming more and more apparent that Trump was going to win, that showed the stock market crashing. It was the overseas markets, and it was, like, down by over 700 points. So I think that would have made a lot of people think the stock market was going to melt down even worse over the next year. In fact, I remember talking to our financial advisor a couple of days later, and, you know, what should we do? And he just said, let's ride it out.
Yeah, which ended up being the right call at the time. But you're right. If you go back to that the particular evening and even the couple of days that followed, there was a lot of concern about this. Well, here's one friend of mine, a guy who's I don't want to introduce or sort of. I'm going to keep people somewhat anonymous, but a friend of mine whose name is Eric works at Amazon.com in Seattle, and he predicted the Bitcoin will be trading at over $1,000, which was sort of a bold prediction at that time, but he totally undershot the mark on that one, as it turned out.
And what is the Bitcoin trading at now?
Oh, gosh, isn't it like 12,000 or something like that? I couldn't even tell you.
I mean, the Bitcoin, it seemed like a joke a year ago.
Exactly, right.
And so, I mean, we're not really going to do a lot about economics today, and neither one of us are economists, but I'm just wondering if you have, what's your take on what does it mean that the Bitcoin has some kind of financial value? Is this like all part of the same syndrome that's created fake news, maybe?
Well, you know, I couldn't tell you, and that's way outside my pay grade, but I do suspect it sort of indicates a growing nervousness about conventional governments and conventional institutions. I mean, that's something we've seen in play now for the last year at least, or probably more than a year. So I think it's kind of, you know, part of that same.
Because my sense, I don't know a lot about Bitcoin. So my sense is it's kind of like make-believe money because there's nothing backing it. So so I think it sort of seems in keeping with the times when it's, in fact, I just saw the movie I, Tanya last night, and the closing line of Tanya Harding's is basically that there's no such thing as truth. Truth is in the eyes of whoever is, you know, wants to say. And I thought that sort of sums up the last year.
Yeah. It does in a lot of ways, and you know, it's interesting how many folks So a lot of folks got a lot of things right. Many people predicted that there would be an invasion and a war by a year out. Thankfully, we haven't seen that happen yet. I think if I were going to fill mine out again for the next year, I'd probably put that back down. But that was something that was very much on people's minds a year ago. I think, again, sort of part of that sense that conventional institutions don't seem up to the task of containing what's this very erratic presidency.
And so, what were some of the did people give specific policy concerns that they were, and things like the executive orders that came down? Was there concern about like really attacking the environment, attacking human rights and civil rights, and everything that matters, basically healthcare, immigration?
Yeah, I will. Let me. I'm thumbing through this here, and I'll read one from a journalist in Seattle named Sarah, and she got something pretty right. She said, 6 months. I had people write down their predictions for 6 months out from the inauguration, a year out, and then 3 years out. And for 6 months out, Sarah said, the Trump administration is already trying to reinstate a registry for people from Muslim-majority countries. There's a huge backlash from Democrats and others. Trump has green-lighted Keystone XL again and reversed the Army Corps' decision on DAPL. But the Standing Rock protests continue. Financial markets for such things as oil companies and private prisons are doing great. And the Trump administration has instated lower taxes on all the highest income brackets.
She did pretty well.
not bad, right? Yeah. And then so she didn't get the timing quite right, but pretty close. And then a year out, she said, Sarah's where I think some of the best ones here. There'll be a risk of impeachment, but it probably won't happen. A sex scandal has emerged. That hasn't exactly happened. Trump has repealed the Clean Power Plan, and Scott Pruitt has loosened EPA regulations of all kinds. Trump has pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. His administration has killed DACA. Mixed bag at a year, but not a terrible prognostication, given what we knew then.
Yeah, well, actually, it sounds like she just hit about on everything. Now, I was wondering, did anybody have any optimistic senses or any sense of the kind of resistance that's actually been created in the wake of that election?
Well, I will say that optimism was not in abundant supply, at least in the folks that I had participated in this. So, interestingly, Barbara, you were the only person who gave me two sets of predictions. If you recall, you gave me a set of predictions for sort of a pessimistic view of the world, and then you gave me a set of predictions for a more optimistic view of the world. And I think your optimistic predictions were the most optimistic of anybody. Now, that being said, your negative predictions are pretty negative. But let's see. What did you say? I'm going to thumb to yours here. And you said, I'm skimming around here. The Paris Climate Treaty is not torn up. Market forces that back increased development of renewable energy and disinvesting from fossil fuel undermine Trump's efforts to restart a coal-based economy. So you got that right. Jobs are not being created fast enough to please Trump's disgruntled backers in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Lawsuits and the ready slowdown efforts to dismantle environmental, civil rights, and immigration rights. Anti-China talk de-escalates, especially after some friction in Taiwan. And momentum grows for midterm elections, which are looking better all the time for Democrats. So those were some optimistic predictions from you that I think were fairly accurate.
Yeah, it's actually good to hear those. I just remember my first ones that came out were all the really negative ones, and I thought I don't want to put this out into the universe. I feel like we have to like be envisioning a way we're going to stand up to this, and so
right. Right. Here's one more thing you wrote down. Actually, at a year out, you predicted the initial FBI and CIA reports that Russia meddled with U.S. elections and helped get Trump elected kick off more rounds of investigations and Senate hearings. As more details and background are released, the media starts to use the word treason to describe Trump's complicity in Russia's cyber attack on U.S. elections.
Well, I was wrong. It was Steve Bannon who used the word.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would have predicted that Bannon would have been the one using that word. But
yeah, I was thinking this morning coming over about how I don't know if any of us would have predicted the fire and the fury coming out. But it seems the timing of this is very interesting. So with these thoughts about we're a year, almost a year into this completely unimaginable regime, let's take stock at what's happening here locally that has been in response. And first of all, I guess what I'd like to do first, let's be positive first, and then we'll start going into the real challenges. But one of the things I remember talking in particular to Dan Sears and Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey right after the election and what they both were saying is, ultimately, what's going to really matter in the next year is what we can do locally, because there's so much local power that we have, particularly around fossil fuel issues and protecting the Columbia watershed. And I think that that's really borne out. So I wanted to talk about how things have shifted in ways that the Trump administration has, in fact, been really stymied in moving ahead with their fossil fuel agenda here in the Northwest.
Yeah, I think that's a great segue from sort of an optimistic perspective on what's happened over the last year, and I do think it's real grounds for optimism. So, as you know, some of listeners may already know this, but the Northwest has been embroiled in this really nasty and large scale series of fights over coal exports, oil by rail schemes, some pipeline schemes in Canada, new gas projects, and so forth. And over the last 7 or 8 years, there has been this tremendous pushback from local communities all around the Northwest, from tribes as well. And the result of that has been that the industry has just suffered loss after loss, and in fact hasn't gotten a single project built at all. And, I think it's fair to say something I work on a lot professionally is fighting those coal and oil projects. And, when Trump was elected, I think it's fair to say that many of us were very, very worried that what would happen would be, basically a full-scale disaster for our efforts to resist fossil fuel expansions in the Northwest. It's nice to report that, basically a year into his presidency, that's not been the case. We've continued to win. We still haven't lost. And if anything, it feels like the momentum is growing. Now, there are some threats on the horizon I think we'll talk about later on today. But for the most part, we're continuing to see sustained and effective resistance to coal and oil projects.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who, if I can see if I can get your new position title correct, he's the programs director for Sightline Institute. What is the difference between that and what you were doing before?
So now I'm basically managing more people. I'm running kind of all of the programs here at Sightline Institute. So we work on housing affordability questions. We work on democracy reform, carbon pricing. And I've got some other sort of administrative tasks. So I'm even busier than I was before.
Okay, less time for specific research and more time to make sure everybody else does their research.
That's right, something like that.
And Eric's been a very long time guest here on Locus Focus. I can't go back. I'm 15 years. I don't remember how long it's been since you've been coming on the show.
Yeah.
But as we look back over the last year, and with this morning, we started out talking about opening a Trump time capsule that Eric compiled last year right after the election that brought this strange new world into being. And we're looking back at how correct people's predictions were about what was going to happen under the Trump administration. And now we're going to look at ways in which the Trump administration has both changed the political and environmental landscape here in the Northwest, but also ways in which they haven't been able to do it. So I wanted to be specific about some of the projects that have, like, some major things have changed, I think, since the last time we talked with some of these projects. And two that come to mind are Millennium Coal, which I think might have already been on the ropes the last time we talked. And then the big news about the Tesoro Savage Vancouver Energy Project, the big oil terminal that they wanted to build in Vancouver, Washington. So let's start with Millennium Coal. And my understanding is the latest developments are that Millennium is now suing the state of Washington because they can't get the permits that they want.
Yes, that's basically right. So the Millennium Coal Export Project is an enormous coal export project. It would move about 44 million tons of coal per year to Asian markets. That would make it the biggest coal export terminal anywhere in North America, certainly in the big leagues, even globally. This was actually the first coal export project that was proposed in the Northwest way back at the end of 2010. Fast forward, through many, many years of contentious arguments and fights over that proposal, the state basically, in the environmental review process, identified 9 characteristics where the project had significant environmental harms that couldn't be mitigated, and so is basically denying permits for that site. Separately, there's also a lease denial for a portion of the property. So the project is is functionally dead at this point. But the backers of that project don't want to acknowledge reality. They don't want to acknowledge the legal reality of Washington State, nor do they want to acknowledge financial reality. So the project backers, it's this obscure little firm called Lighthouse Resources. They have just initiated a lawsuit against Washington in order to try to get the decision reversed. I don't think the lawsuit has much of a chance at all, but that's the state of play with that particular project.
Well, speaking of lawsuits, this is another example, I think, of where we were really sure that we could make a strong stand on a local level and control our destiny, and that had to do with Portland passing an ordinance that basically bans fossil fuel infrastructure over a certain size, but mass storage of fossil fuel infrastructure being built in the city. And we were congratulating ourselves in a big way right after the election in 2016 because it got passed right after that, or at least it was about to go to the vote, and then it was actually voted on in December. Then the next step was that the Portland Business Alliance and some of their cronies appealed the ordinance to the Land Use Board of Appeals in the state, saying that Portland didn't have a right to basically interfere with interstate commerce, which is what they saw this being. And then there were some other issues about it. Much to people's surprise, the Land Use Board of Appeals upheld that appeal and basically null and voided the ban that Portland had instituted. So then the city and a bunch of other nonprofit groups filed an appeal. And we just heard word a couple weeks ago that the Land Use Board of Appeals decision was overturned, and basically Portland's infrastructure ban on fossil fuel storage stands. But it was an indication of, the tenuousness, I think, actually, of local control. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, and how does this show that we do still have that kind of local control to stand up in the face of Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short answer to that question is yes, we definitely do. But it's worth kind of exploring a longer version of the answer, because what's happening in Portland, what has happened in Portland, is so very important for many other communities in the Northwest. So, what's been happening, like I mentioned, is Northwest communities have been fighting back these coal and oil and gas projects for years now and winning. But they've been winning in all kinds of different peculiar ways that are, sometimes based on economics, sometimes based on tribal treaty rights, sometimes based on a lawsuit, sometimes on activism. Anyway, you get the idea. All these different reasons. But we've mostly been playing defense. That is to say, an oil by rail project will come to town, they'll propose to build something, and then we'll fight it and win. Or a pipeline will get proposed, we'll fight it and win. The idea behind the Portland infrastructure ban was to kind of flip that script around, and instead of playing defense, was to proactively say, well, look, we're going to actually just change the zoning rules, the land use rules in our community to prevent this stuff from coming in and monkeying with our institutions. We don't want these projects. We know that in advance, so let's have our land use projects or our land use law reflect that. Now, what's interesting, so Portland is by far the best and most comprehensive version of that, but it actually started in a small way in Aberdeen and Hoquiam, which are two little little towns, little sort of politically purple towns on Grays Harbor, and then in Vancouver, Washington, where those communities had been facing down proposals for oil by rail projects, and subsequent to getting these proposals and finding that there was a huge community backlash, people don't want large amounts of crude oil in their community, then the city councils had gone back and revised their zoning codes, basically, and said, look, in the future, we can't affect these projects on the table, but in the future, we're not going to allow anything that looks like a large crude oil storage facility. It's just not going to be allowed by zoning. And so what that basically did was, although they had to still wrestle with the projects that were on the table, it basically prevented future stuff from happening. And I think that instinct, that basic recipe, really kind of initiated this big idea, this big movement, that then really took hold in Portland. After Portland beat back a proposal for a propane by rail export facility, then the city of Portland got this audacious idea that they would change land use law and zoning comprehensively in the city to prevent any sort of large-scale fossil fuel export scheme, and then went about over the next, I guess, almost year sort of doing all the legwork behind this and enacting what is far and away the most comprehensive and thoroughgoing rejection of fossil fuel export material anywhere in the country. It may be in the world. I don't know, but it's certainly, especially for a large city with an industrial base, it's really shocking just how comprehensive what Portland did is. And so we all believe that that is basically the future, that that's what we're going to try to do in city after city, town after town around the Northwest. So when the Land Use Appeal Board had sort of provisionally rejected the idea, that was a pretty big blow. It's nice now that the appellate court has come in and said, no, of course, this is completely legal. Cities have well-documented, it's well-known, well-understood that they have the power to govern their own zoning, and that's something that's very allowable. So Portland's in a good place now, and I think it sets the stage for further successes around the region.
Well, I was actually listening to an interview with Don Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper a few days ago about this, and he's being guarded still because there was one provision that got thrown back to the city that they have to kind of tweak, and he mentions that the Portland Business Alliance is like willing to work with the city to make this ordinance more user-friendly, probably, to fossil fuel companies. So it's still, I mean, so the vigilance of the part of citizens and organizations that stood up for 2.5, 3 years, and including the Pembina struggle, I guess 3.5 years, to get Portland to do this ordinance needs to come back together, and we'll be reporting on this in the next few weeks because it's certainly going to be something. As much as I think we have the support of City Council, I think we really have to all be there in force in the community to remind City Council of who they represent. And hopefully the people who are representing the fossil fuel industry will be as ridiculous as they were in 2016. Well, there's the other big news, of course, is what's happening with the Vancouver Energy Project. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, and so that's a great one to segue to. So I mentioned Vancouver, Washington just a moment ago. The project that has been plaguing Vancouver, Washington for, golly, almost 5 years now, was a giant oil-by-rail facility. It would have taken 5 or 6 oil trains per day, transferred that oil into big storage tanks, and then shipped it out on tankers on the Columbia River. It would have been the biggest oil-by-rail facility in the country at 360,000 barrels per day, so that's the size of a pretty decent-sized pipeline, but all of that oil moving on rail. And it's been a tremendously controversial project in Vancouver. Most folks there strongly oppose the project. It's created huge political waves in that system. And the news we got in, I guess, December was very heartening. And it goes like this. So in Washington, there is a particular permitting agency that governs large-scale energy projects. So if you have a big project of this scale, you get sort of exempted from local permitting, and you go to this this governing body called EFSEC, which stands for Energy Facility Siting and Evaluation Council, which doesn't really matter. But anyway, EFSEC does the environmental review, and then they make a recommendation to the governor. And the governor is the only voice that matters. By Washington state law, he basically gets the recommendation from EFSEC, and then he can approve it, deny it, or reject the proposal, and or approve it, or reject it, or modify the proposal. And so what EFSEC said in December was, we unanimously recommend that the governor reject this proposal, and we deny and deny permits for it. So that was a huge blow to the oil industry backers who were trying to get this project built. It sets the stage very nicely for Governor Inslee, who has a long track record of environmental leadership, to deny the project. He's got all the basis he needs to deny it. And so we expect that will happen probably late this month or early next.
Well, and there's another prong to the struggle, which has to do with the composition of the Vancouver Port Commission, which changed dramatically, or will tomorrow, with the seating of Don Orange, the new port commissioner. So let's talk a little bit about that struggle. And that also ties into the sort of electoral shift, sea change that we started noticing in November.
Yeah. So it's an interesting story. Like I said a minute ago, that project has just sent shockwaves through the political system in Vancouver, Washington. It's been super, super contentious there. And so what has happened is, basically, the Port Commission, which is a three-person elected commission in Vancouver that governs the port there, they basically had leased some land to Tesoro, which is a big oil company, to build this project. And they did that in ways that were sort of underhanded and not very well communicated to the public. The public was very upset about it. The city council was opposed to the project but couldn't sort of intervene with what the port had decided. So, you know, 2 years ago, we had a guy named Eric LeBrant run for port commission. He won on an staunchly anti-oil platform in the most expensive port race in Vancouver by a country mile. I mean, it was maybe two or three times as expensive as any previous port race. So that gave the anti-oil forces one seat among three on the city council or on the port commission. And then in November, we replayed that, and we saw another anti-oil candidate run for office, a guy named Don Orange. And that campaign was, I think, two or three times as expensive as the previous campaign. So it was really a major showdown between the oil industry and the environmental community. Don Orange was elected in a landslide. So now there are two of the three port commissioners who are anti-oil. And the port commissioners still matter in this case because basically the company has a lease for some port land there. And and that lease has to be renewed, I think, every 6 months. So now that when Don Orange takes his seat on the port commission, they will be able to decline to renew the lease for Tesoro, thereby killing the project off. Even if they were to get permits and get approval from the governor, which they won't, but even if they were, they still got this big problem with the port now. And I think what it signals is that not only has the Vancouver port got a lot more progressive and a lot more environmentally responsible, but it demonstrates that the sort of the electorate really matters. The electorate can intervene and just take these bodies away from the industry-friendly backers who have kind of owned them for years and years.
Well, I was thinking how on November 7th of this year, lots of eyes were looking at, particularly Virginia, where there was quite a major shift in the politics and the victory of a lot of Democrats in the state, and they almost took back the state House of Delegates, except I guess they didn't have a lucky draw in that strange race. But there was some attention in Washington nationally, particularly at the there was a state Senate race that where it shifted, and a Democrat won the seat and shifted the control of the state Senate in Washington from Republican to Democrat. There wasn't as much national focus on the Port Commission election, though I did actually see a little bit. But it seems that this election, in a way, is maybe showing the power in the deepest levels of what the grassroots can do.
I think it absolutely is. And you're right, it didn't get the national attention that some other races did, although it got some. I mean, I actually did a radio interview on To the Point on NPR about it, and we got some other good coverage. But anyway, I think it really does demonstrate that that a lot of these decisions have a direct linkage back to, you know, a relatively small number of voters in these communities, and I think that's especially in these times when it feels like government democracy is so broken in some ways at the federal level. I think it really, to me, I really find it sort of inspiring and encouraging that the community of Vancouver, Washington, can get together and have a real substantive conversation about a project that matters. And the consequence of a conversation like that is a much better outcome for the environment. It's a much more progressive outcome. And, you know, I really see in a lot of these battles about fossil fuels that we are kind of reinvigorating investment in local democracy, because that's ultimately where it's all going to start, I think. That's ultimately where the resistance is going to spring from. And so I find it very encouraging. The more we talk about these fossil fuel projects at a local level, I think the better we do.
Well, this morning we're talking with Eric DePlace, who is with Sightline Institute. He's their programs director, and we're talking about basically now looking forward, looking back a little bit as to how much impact the Trump administration has actually had on environmental struggles here in the Northwest, and looking forward to what we are going to be experiencing this year. And kind of as a transition into that, I want to talk about the methanol refinery that's being proposed for Coloma, Washington, which seemed like it was going to be a slam dunk just about a year ago. And then things shifted. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on there. Maybe first of all, why this particular project has gotten a lot less notice than the projects up in Tacoma or in Vancouver. And if there's a possibility that even this project might be killed.
Yeah, great question. So this is the Coloma methanol refinery is sort of one of three Godzilla fossil fuel projects that have been proposed for the Columbia recently. So the first one was the Millennium Bulk Coal that we talked about. Then there was this big oil train facility at Vancouver, and then this methanol refinery at Calama is the third. It's enormous. It would be, I think, the biggest methanol production site anywhere on Earth, and it's all for export to China, probably for plastics, but maybe for vehicle fuel. Now, why has it gotten less attention than some other projects? It's a good question. I mean, one of the reasons is that it's in a little town called Calama, so it's kind of outside of major population centers. It's also a little bit complex to explain the project, and let me do that just real briefly before I get to the third reason. So basically what this would do is it would pipe down huge quantities of natural gas from Canada, more gas than is consumed in every power plant in Washington combined, just for this one site. Then it would basically convert that natural gas, that methane gas, into a liquid petrochemical called methanol. And then once it's done that conversion, then it would ship that out on tankers in the Columbia River to China. So it's a big, nasty project. It's got all kinds of environmental downside. It initially, curiously enough, had backing from the Washington governor's office. They sort of stepped back from that position, it seems. But there was originally, when it was proposed, the backers kind of came up with this, you know, big smokescreen about how green and clean and environmentally responsible this project was. And a few folks actually seemed to buy it. Without looking at much at the evidence at all, and the evidence does not support that claim. And so partly as a consequence of that, you didn't see the big coordinated anti-coal movement in there. You didn't see the big coordinated anti-oil movement in there. And so this project was kind of left to its own devices. It got pretty far through the review process and was actually, I think, starting to get its initial permits when one of the key review agencies came back and said, look, this project does nothing adequate to address the greenhouse gas implications of a fossil fuel endeavor of this scale. And so they said, well, look, you've got to go back to the drawing board and you've got to get the math right on carbon emissions before we can approve this project. I was very surprised to see that decision. I thought the project was all but done for. That is all but approved, and so when we saw that, it's going to delay the you know permitting process for that project by probably a year or so, and it deals a very big blow to the backers because it gives the anti-fossil fuel community all of the time it needs to organize and really put some spotlight on that project. It's now, I think, going to get the attention that it's deserved all along, as the other projects have died off.
Well, actually, I'm going up there tomorrow night to meet with the community who's been fighting that project, so I'll be learning a lot more about it, and I'll be talking a lot more on the show about this in the next few weeks.
Yes, and as you may know, there was a new, speaking of politics related to fossil fuel fights, there's a new mayor elected in Calama, and he won with, I think, 46 or 47% of the vote, and in Calama, that was a plurality enough to win against two other contenders. And I think his total vote total was less than 400 votes. So, you know, it's a small community. He doesn't actually have any jurisdiction over that particular site, but it goes to show that in a small community like that, you can begin to make real political waves from opposing these big, nasty projects that will damage the communities.
Well, one of the things that was kind of disheartening to me, I went to a hearing last winter the hearing was in Longview, in one of those couple places, venues they have for all these state and regional hearings. And it was I think it was Cowlitz County. No, it was the Southwest Air Board for Washington. And they were reviewing a proposal from Northwest Innovation Works. And it was elected official after elected official, both the county commissioners and the city council, just coming in and talking about what a wonderful project this was and how it was bringing much needed jobs to Calama and how depressed Calama was and how few jobs there were and how much, you know, issues there were with meth and other problems like that. And there were, I'd say the room was overwhelming number of people in the room were against the proposal, but the people that represent the community officially were all in favor of it, which was very different than going to hearings around Vancouver Energy or going to any hearings in Portland. And so I'm assuming that this new mayor that's been elected to Calama may have a different perspective than all the people that were speaking at the hearing last year.
Well, very much so. I mean, he ran essentially on an anti-methanol platform, and that was his signature issue. And you're right. I mean, Cowlitz County has been The leadership there has been a really pro fossil fuel development, much at odds actually with the community. And the community is divided, but you would expect that there would be a sort of better representation of leadership of what the community actually feels. And I think we're starting to see that change now, and I think it will continue to happen over the next few years as these fights become political fights. I mean, which ultimately they are on some level, because it's political leaders who invite these companies in, who issue the leases, who run interference for them. And so, you know, it's not surprising that the resistance movement has taken to the polls to elect different leaders.
Well, speaking of frack gas, let's move on to some other projects. And we're going to get back now to the impacts that the Trump administration has had on ongoing struggles in the Northwest here in Oregon. And I guess one of the most disheartening ones was the struggle around the proposed LNG terminal in Jordan Cove near Coos Bay. This a fight that's been going on for how many years?
Yeah, I don't even know how many years it's been going on, but it's a long time. The Jordan Cove export project is a pretty big liquefied natural gas proposal down in Coos Bay, and it would take gas piped in from a couple of different locations. And then it would liquefy it, that is, super cool it and condense it, and then ship it out for export. The LNG projects are risky just from a health and safety perspective. It's also, from a greenhouse gas perspective, not a good idea at all. I think it would be the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state, not even counting what happens when you burn all that gas at the end of the pipe or at the end of the project. But that project was... fought, and it eventually, much to everyone's surprise, was rejected by FERC. FERC is the federal regulatory agency that governs permitting for these kinds of projects, and they are considered a very industry-friendly body, so it's very unusual to see a denial from them. But they denied the project late in the Obama years and said, there are some risks associated with this project, and we don't see any compensating benefit because we don't think you can sell this gas. We don't think you have a market for it or buyer for it. So they spiked the project. I opened a bottle of champagne, raised a glass, said that's another one down. And it turns out that may have been premature because the Trump administration has now signaled that it really wants to get some LNG projects built. It wants one on the West Coast, and it has identified Jordan Cove as its primary target. That is the main location on the West Coast that the Trump administration would like to see built and permitted. And so that really puts a lot of attention back on the Southern Oregon coast, both for the construction of a pipeline that would feed the project and then for the facility itself. I think that's going to be maybe the big issue to watch in the Northwest over the next year or two.
Now, one of the interesting things was FERC didn't just reject it once. It rejected it twice.
That's right, yeah.
And then as soon as Trump was elected, this is even before he was inaugurated, the company came back. And then FERC was like dysfunctional. They didn't have a quorum for a while, and now Trump has appointed, I'm assuming, was it two very friendly, fossil fuel friendly commissioners, and it's looking very different than it was looking under the Obama years.
That's exactly right, and I think it is worrisome because it is an example of where the Trump administration can begin to staff some of these regulatory agencies with folks who are much more interested in doing industry's bidding. And much less interested in environmental protection.
However,
and FERC was already pretty weighted that way, so this is not a good calculus.
However, FERC is not the only one who has a say on this. I understand that there's another person who could stop it, and that's Kate Brown, our governor here. And in fact, people are going down to Salem on Thursday to demand that she just do just that. So what role does Kate Brown have in it? And could she, even if FERC were to approve the pipeline, does Oregon have the final say about whether, because we're talking actually, the issue is to do with this pipeline that they need to build to go to get from the existing supply of frack gas to the facility that would be built at Jordan Cove. So do you know if Kate Brown herself, actually like Jay Inslee, would be able to stop the Jacero Savage project? Could Kate Brown stop the Jordan Cove project?
Well, my understanding of the regulatory mechanisms in Oregon maybe not quite as sophisticated as it ought to be, but it's, the mechanisms are a bit different in Oregon. So there's not, so FSEC is pretty peculiar, where it actually takes this stuff and puts it on one person's desk, on Governor Inslee's desk. I don't think it works the same way in Oregon, but you do have state agency decisions about permitting that can stop that project. So it's not just that they need approval from FERC; they also need a whole bunch of permits from the state as well. And so, you know, I always think about these. You know, in order to get a fossil fuel project built, you have to run a gauntlet, basically. And you've got to. I've only got to beat the project once. I've only got to kill it on one reason, and they've got to succeed on everything. So I think going to the governor's office in Oregon is the right move because it does signal that Oregon actually has a decisive role in this, and the state can decide whether or not to permit the project. So I think that attention is absolutely correct. I was very pleased to see Senator Merkley step out and say, I don't think this is consistent with Oregon's environmental values. This project is a stupid project. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he said. So that was encouraging. And I think it's incumbent now on the environmental movement to make clear that liquefied natural gas exports are a horrible idea from an environmental perspective. It's not a bridge fuel. It is not cleaner than coal. It is just all downside. And I think as that notion becomes stronger, as that belief becomes stronger, as the evidence becomes stronger, I think then we can expect Governor Brown to step up and do the right thing, I hope, and direct her state agencies to do the right thing.
Well, for those of you who are free on Thursday, this is more information about the rally. It's called Stand Up for Our Climate, Stop the Pipeline. And it's actually done in conjunction with Oil Change, the national organization that's been doing great research about all kinds of fossil fuel issues. And they released a paper about the Jordan Cove project and the pipeline that needs to be built in order to make that project happen. And so they're going to be speaking. They'll be a representative from Oil Change at the rally. Anyway, it starts at 12:30. It's at the Oregon State Capitol Building, 900 Court Street Northeast in Salem. And it runs from 12:30 to 1:30. If you're interested in lobbying, there's going to be a lobbying workshop going from 11:30 to 1:30, and lobbying begins at 1:45. And for more information, I'm looking for their website, but if you go to PDX, 350.org PDX, they'll definitely have information about it. And there'd be ride sharing as well to get down there. So that's a rally on Thursday to stop frack gas in Oregon and to stop the Jordan Cove. And you are listening right now to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, and we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who is the programs director for Sightline Institute in Seattle. And we're talking about, well, actually what we're going to shift into now is to talk more about frack gas and how this is really the fossil fuel issue, I think, of 2018. It looks like we may have stopped the last oil terminal proposal in the Northwest and the last coal terminal in the Northwest, but particularly in the guise of LNG terminals and as well as the methanol terminal proposed for Calama, it seems like this is still the brave new frontier for the fossil fuel industry and the place where there's a lot of discussion and disagreement, it seems, on the part of liberals and maybe even some progressives and even some environmentalists about the role that frack gas can have as being played as a bridge fuel to get us to an all renewable future. And for me, and one of the things that I've been learning from talking to activists is like changing language. And the first thing maybe we need to do to change the understanding of what frack gas is to stop calling it natural gas, which is a PR term, and to talk about what it really is, which is methane, and how it's really mostly derived now, which is through fracking. So, Eric, how do we get this? How do we help to sort of change? Well, let's first of all talk about why it's such a problem. Why is it so contentious to even be discussing frack gas as a fossil fuel that needs to be stopped?
Yeah, that's right at the heart of this debate is this question. So those of us who've been studying energy policy for a long time, I have a very bad habit where I continue to call it natural gas because that is sort of the term of art that's used by industry. So what natural gas is a hydrocarbon fuel that is extracted from the ground, and it's about, you call it 85 or 90, maybe 95% methane gas, some other stuff in there too, and then that product is sort of cleaned up and processed a little bit, and then we burn it to produce electricity or to heat homes and things like this. Now, gas these days is more and more often extracted by fracking, and will be extracted more by fracking in the future. And so, without kind of getting into all the details of it, it used to be that conventionally extracted gas, from a greenhouse gas perspective and from an air quality perspective, was notably better than burning coal. Like, you would rather live next to a gas burning facility than next to a coal burning facility. Now, when you do all of the environmental calculations for a fracking operation and look at the potential for leakage, look at the other environmental harms and so forth, then it starts to look like, and especially because the research on this is actually evolving and changing, gas is much worse than we thought. Now it starts to look like the gas is actually no better than coal. Maybe it's worse than coal. Maybe it's a tiny bit better, but not much. And it's certainly not anything like what we used to say, or what people used to say back in the 70s. They used to say, well, gas could be a bridge fuel that will take us from coal to a renewable future. And people still sometimes use that language as if gas will help us get away from coal to something better. But in reality, what gas would do, especially this, you know, fracked gas, which is fundamentally what it is these days, it's you're bridging from coal into something that's just as bad as coal from a climate perspective, and you're delaying by 20 or 30 or 40 years the real uptake in renewables that we need. What we need are solar, wind, geothermal, energy efficiency, a million other things. Those can get sidelined and delayed if we build more fracked gas infrastructure. So. But there's this real problem, because when you ask people what they think about coal and oil, they mostly have pretty negative responses. They're kind of with the environmental community already. They kind of want something cleaner than that. When you ask them what they think about natural gas, they seem to like it. They seem to like it a lot. Now, when you ask them about fracked gas, then the equation changes. And then people start to realize, oh, actually, there are a lot of environmental harms associated with this, which is correct. And so we really need to start rethinking and rebranding the way we talk about this, so we're not just parroting the industry's line, which is what they want us to do.
Well, another part of it is, I'm just thinking about my own lifestyle. I remember, well, when we bought our house 25 years ago, we took out an oil furnace and we put in a gas furnace. In fact, we put a gas line in from the street, and we put in a gas stove, gas furnace, and then eventually a gas water heater, and then we got a gas radiant heater for the living room, and we thought we were doing the right thing, and it seemed like it was better than, like, especially the gas burner in the living room was instead of a wood stove, which we'd used in our other house to heat, because wood was turning out, it was not a good fuel. It was both its greenhouse gas emissions and also in terms of all other kinds of pollution. So in 1993, this looked like a very progressive thing to do. Obviously, I look back at it now, and I look at this major investment that we personally made in natural gas, and, you know, I'm scratching my head, and what do we do about it? So that's one big problem. I mean, that people have really invested on a personal level in natural gas for things that are really important, like keeping warm and cooking our food. And so I think that that's another question to have is, besides getting people to understand that this gas that's gotten cheaper and cheaper in the last 15 years is actually coming from fracked sources and destroying lives all around everywhere where it's fracked, that we need to have to find some way to rethink the way that we're going to take care of these very vital needs ourselves. And I wonder how we go about doing that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I will say, I mean, somewhat in your defense, like 25 years ago, that probably was a reasonably smart environmental choice. I mean, moving away from oil at that point made good sense, certainly, and would. I mean, certainly better for air quality. And the gas supply was different then. And the electricity supply was different. So if you had moved directly to electricity, you would have been basically getting electricity that was generated by coal or by gas. Nowadays, that's less and less true. As we are cleaning up the electricity grid, so now, you know, increasingly, and most of the forecasts for the future support this view, the power that comes into our plugs is going to be generated more and more by renewables, including hydro, and less and less by the dirty old stuff. So nowadays, it makes more sense to move directly to an electric system for a lot of those choices, including for our transportation system. So, you know, kind of the path for progress, it looks like to almost everybody at this point, is going to be continuing to clean up the electricity grid, continuing to wring efficiencies out of a relatively inefficient electrical system, although the Northwest is pretty good, and then transition away from the dirty old fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, coal, oil, and fracked gas, to a clean electricity system. And that seems to be kind of the path forward. But it's not at all, nobody would have necessarily known that. It wasn't actually true 25 years ago. Our electricity grid kind of wasn't developing in the way that it's developing now. I feel like I lost the thread of your question. And
what should I actually? I'm thinking. Well, the next appliance that needs to be replaced over time would be a hot water heater, and that's easy to change. And electric hot water heaters now are probably way more efficient than gas hot water heaters, and way safer.
Right.
And I can stop worrying about that earthquake when I have an electric hot water heater. But it's things like furnaces. I mean, I know a lot of people, including ourselves, who bought a new furnace in the last few years, and they're very efficient. They're wonderful. I would never have thought I would love my furnace as much as our radiant heater. And every time I turn it on, I think about now fracking. So, I mean, I think that there's a mindset that, I mean, I don't think that people like me are going to be able to change that kind of investment in the near future. But I guess, how do we start really educating people to think in terms of an electric lifestyle that is as pleasurable as the kind of heat that you get from radiant heat and from a good gas furnace?
Yeah, well, I think some of it starts with the kind of conversation we're having now, is getting people to recognize that using fracked gas in your home is not necessarily an environmentally responsible decision. So some of that does flow down to the individual level. You know, on the other hand, I think most people they're not trying to do something wrong, and most people aren't really trying to do something right either. They're just sort of responding to incentives, trying to make reasonably economical choices. And so what we want to do, I think, from my perspective, is at the policy level, we want to make sure that our state and local policies reflect the environmental benefits that we're striving for, and the environmental risks that we're trying to avoid. And hopefully what that would include would be maybe some subsidies, maybe some encouragement for the installation of better technologies. I mean, for example, heat pump technology, which is common in new homes now, is a radical improvement. I mean, it's just a huge change in the amount of energy consumed to heat and cool a home, even in the temperate Northwest. And so as we see new construction move to heat pump technology, and then older homes are, over time kind of trickling into that technology, we're getting a tremendous improvement in energy efficiency that way. And we're getting all the same benefit in terms of heating and, in fact, cooling your home, too, for a fraction of the energy that we used to use. And so some of it is new technological development, but then we need the policy to support it as well. So, we should definitely have a conversation about it, but the conversation should not end with personal choices. Although that's important, we also need to make sure that that gets elevated up to your city council, to your county council, to your state, to make sure that all the policy dials and levers are set appropriately.
So in the last few moments, I wonder if we can talk a bit about this burgeoning movement to stop the further development of fracked gas. Do you see that this is actually starting to take form?
I do, and it's really remarkable to me. I think the most interesting place right now for this debate is in Tacoma, Washington. The big Western Washington utility called Puget Sound Energy is trying to build this liquefied natural gas facility basically in the downtown Tacoma, in the industrial port area there. It's mostly for local consumption, for some vessels and for heating and so forth. And it has generated a tremendous amount of backlash recently. It is being protested almost daily. People are getting arrested at the gates. The local tribe, the Puyallup Indian Nation, is fighting the project now. And it has become this real referendum in Tacoma on whether or not they're going to allow more fossil fuel infrastructure in place, or whether they're not going to. Now, interestingly enough, the project does not yet have all of its permits, and they're starting construction at the same time. And so it's really queued up, this extremely rancorous, frankly, debate. It's affected many local races, both in the Port Commission and at City Council and Mayor's races, and got a pretty evenly divided community where this project, Tacoma LNG, is center stage. So, I would encourage folks to get involved with Tacoma if you have any connection to it at all. And really, I think, to watch how that debate plays out, because I think it's a good indicator of the debates we'll be having over the next year, two, three, 4 years.
And that'll be our next conversation in a few months.
I look forward to it.
Okay, well, it's always good to talk with you, Eric. Thanks a whole lot.
Likewise, Barbara. Thank you.
We've been talking with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll get an update from Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper on the ongoing fossil fuel struggles along the Columbia River. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Alan Toussaint. Thanks for listening.
Now is the time. Now is the time for all good men to get together with one another. Iron out their problems and iron out their quarrels and try to live as brothers. And try to find peace within without stepping on one another. And do respect of the women of the world, just remember we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land in the world in which we live.
And help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. And I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know done well we can work it out.
Oh, yeah.